Latinx podcasters are making an impact. Keep listening to discover our faves, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Welcome to Not Your Average Joe, the podcast that will make anyone a little less average. I'm your host, Joe Franco, and I'm so excited to get into this. I'm a writer, a TV host, a content creator, and a polyglot. And throughout all of these experiences, I've met some of the most fascinating people all around the world that I'd love to introduce you to. We'll have conversations about different topics, ranging from finance to fitness to language learning and wanderlust. With each episode, we'll dissect real-life stories and turn them into tangible takeaways so that we can all be a little less average. I learn, you learn, we all learn. Don't forget to like and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything. Hey, everybody. I'm Sarah Edmondson.
And I'm Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy.
And we just want to welcome you to season three of A Little Bit Culty. Once upon a time, we were in a cult called Nexium.
We didn't know it was a cult when we joined, because as a wise man once said, nobody joins a cult. They join a good thing.
For a minute, it was a good thing. That's where we met, fell in love, got married, started a family.
The stuff of storybooks.
Even the part where we woke up, escaped, became whistleblowers, and helped bring it all down? You call that shit show a storybook?
Seeing the mastermind of Nexium get sentenced to 120 years in prison? That's a storybook ending, if you ask me.
The whole thing was captured on HBO's hit docuseries, The Vow.
A new season is coming out any moment, if it isn't out already by the time you hear this.
And I published a memoir called Scarred, which is available anywhere books are sold.
And now we have a podcast.
Every week on A Little Bit Culty, we call on experts, advocates, fellow survivors, and whistleblowers to help us unpack what's going on in the cultiverse.
And now we're turning our story into wisdom for other people.
Like, I wish I'd known that calling yourself Vanguard was a bit of a red flag.
Yeah, big red flag. We've got a lot to cover. So let's get this show rolling, shall we?
Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, an Acast podcast about the fads, beliefs, and trends that blur the line between devotion and destruction. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And to learn more, visit us on Instagram or alittlebitculty.com. How's it going, babe?
What up to A Little Bit Culty, the cultiverse.
In the cultiverse, there's so many things happening.
In spite of our efforts, it's still there.
I'm constantly blown away every day, probably what, like 5 to 10 emails about people suggesting different things to cover. And there's obviously some overlap.
You know, I look forward to the day where we end our podcast because there's no more cults to talk about.
One day. And sometimes we just get emails or messages on Instagram like this one I wanted to share because it just, I don't even want to say it brings me joy. None of this really brings joy when I hear about the effects, because obviously this is just such a huge clusterfuck.
It's always bittersweet.
It's always bittersweet. Well, first of all, like I love when people send us in their stories or in their Instagram of like them listening to their pod while they're working out or while they're, you know, folding laundry and just knowing that this is out in the world and it affects people. And this was the note that we got that I wanted to share. Hey guys, just thought I'd send you a sweet note to chuckle your evening away. I had to take a job at Amazon recently, and what's great about this is that every morning that I have to make that drive, part of my morning scenery is the brightly lit facility Tucson that Keith is housed in. It's part of my morning routine to wave at him for you, and I say, "Morning, Keith," and I snicker and I revel in the thought that you took him down. Just the thought that there are people out there that think about you and are happy that you've moved on. Thank you for doing your part to rid our society from this sickness. Peace.
That's
Peace
awesome.
Out. Isn't that kind of, I like that image of somebody waving at him. No, I didn't get emotional.
Oh, I thought did not. We're having Sarah's emotional moment.
Nope.
like right away actually, in the beginning of our podcast.
And I'm almost,
you save it for the end.
I'm pretty sure this episode does not have an emotional moment. It is a bit of a diversion from our normal routine.
I tease because I love Sarah. That's all.
I know. I know. I love you too. So yeah.
Speaking of Van Dusen Jail, this is something that happened probably 2 months ago. But a former jailmate of NXIVM leader Keith Raniere, who duped investors into pouring millions of dollars into non-existent film projects, is facing more time behind bars after prosecutors said he tried to repeat the scam using a would-be documentary about NXIVM.
Yeah, it's just the irony that Keith befriends somebody in jail, says, hey, when you got out, contact this guy and make a film with him. And then that guy, by the way, the guy's in jail for like defrauding people.
He went back to jail for the very
thing. We can't really touch that one.
I don't even know what to say to that.
We'll just leave it as is. It's just blah.
Yeah.
This upcoming episode, I think, is, like I said, it's very different than our others. And it's a nice break for us. And I'm going to suggest that you read the book. We'll post on our stories before Monday so you can read it if you like. I think it's a great read. Again, thanks everyone for the support. We've gotten a lot of requests to put up a link where people could throw some funds behind the podcast and help support what A Little Bit Culty is doing. As we've gotten to know other podcasters and more about how this whole thing works, we've been learning that it takes a whole lot of different sources of revenue to keep it rolling. Sponsorships and ads and listener support. So we've just added a way for anyone who wants to support the show to do so. You can go to alittlebitculty.com/support or the link in our Instagram bio to make a one-time contribution or a recurring one. We super appreciate it. Again, it's alittlebitculty.com/support or check out the link in our bio on the gram. On with the show.
Miranda Beverly Whittemore is a New York Times bestselling author of Bittersweet, June, and Set Me Free. A recipient of the Crazy Horse Prize in Fiction, Miranda lives and writes in upstate Vermont, and her newest novel, Fierce Little Thing, delves into a culty story.
You could say that it's a little like I Know What You Did Last Summer, except in this case, it's I Know What You Did When You Were a Teenager 20 summers ago while living on a survivalist commune run by a charismatic maniac in rural Maine. A juicy read for sure. I loved this book.
This is a little bit different for A Little Bit Culty. We normally talk to former cult members or cult experts.
But we wanted to sit down with her after reading Fierce Little Thing because we think there's a conversation worth having about how communes can turn culty and what we think about when we talk about cult fiction, especially since we lived it in real life. And for those of you who have not yet read the book, here's the inside cover in my best voice. Saskia was a damaged, lonely teenager when she arrived at the lakeside commune called home. She was entranced by the tang of sourdough starter, the midnight call of the loons, the triumph of foraging wild mushrooms from the forest floor. But most of all, she was taken with Abraham, home's charismatic leader, the North Star to Saskia and the four other teens who lived there, her best and only friends. 2 decades later, Saskia shuttered in her Connecticut estate, estranged from the others. Her carefully walled life is torn open by threatening letters. Unless she and her former friends return to the land in rural Maine, the terrible thing they did as teenagers, their last-ditch attempt to save home, will be revealed. From vastly different lives, the five return to confront their blackmailer and reckon with the horror that split them apart. How far will they go to bury their secret forever? Read more about it. Fierce Little Thing by Miranda Beverly Whittemore, available anywhere books are sold. And now, without further ado, Miranda Beverly Whittemore. Hi.
Hi, Miranda. Nice to meet you.
Hi. I wanted to tell you because everyone always has a hard time. My last name is pronounced Beverly Whittemore.
Got it.
Beverly Whittemore is my last name. It's my hippie parents' last name.
We both have hippie parents.
Speaking of
hippie
parents,
I knew we'd find more commonality.
And actually, we have another connection because my brother-in-law, Rubidium, who grew up in Australia, grew up with Bonnie.
No way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a small cultiverse.
Small world. Cultiverse, yeah. Right?
It is small cultiverse for sure. I have to tell you, part of our, you know, healing, as you know, is in cult recovery is we absorb so much cult content to get ready for the podcast. And
oh, I bet
it's helped me with my sanity, but also have to balance it. And reading your book was such a great treat for me because this fiction, and I haven't read a fiction book in so long, but it was still relevant for the research. and still was like in line with this template that I've seen across the board in every cult documentary, every book, every experience that anyone's ever gone through has the same processes of abuse and the same boxes to check off. You know, the charismatic mm-hmm. leader and the doctrine and the way of living. Well, I have so many questions about it. But first of all, I want to just tell you how much I loved the book. Just loved it.
Thank you. So, that means
yeah,
the world
it was
to me.
So good. And I'm recommending it to everyone who'll listen, but not in a culty way. Also, quick sidebar, as a voice actor, I was so impressed by your narrator because I ended up listening to the book, even though you did send me a hard copy.
Yeah. And her name is Saskia.
Isn't that wild?
That woman, that actor's name is Saskia.
I feel like I need to like meet her and learn from her because I was listening to it going, I could not do what she did. She was phenomenal. Like she had all these different voices and these different, and also like she plays Saskia, your lead, at different times in her life. And even that had different voices.
I know, it's such an amazing gift to be able to tell a story like that with your voice. Blows me away. Yes. It's such a particular kind of acting.
It was a very particular kind of acting. Like I said, I don't think I'm ready for that. I've only narrated two books, my own book and then a cult recovery book by Janja Lalić. Mm-hmm. So I've never read a fiction book. I'd like to, mm-hmm. but like I said, that was next level. Really, really good. So it was very satisfying for me, the whole book. A, as a voiceover actress, B, as a former cult member, C, as a woman. I felt it was a very powerful, female-driven empowerment story.
Thank you. I mean, that's the part of it that really was so important to me. But one of the entry points to the book was to kind of explore a woman who has been weaponized to support the movement of a man who is destructive and how she can come back from that. Is it possible to? That was one of the big questions I was asking myself as I wrote the book.
And I have more questions about your writing process. But before we do that, just for our listeners who haven't yet read the book, and of course, we highly recommend it, especially because so many of our listeners are in cult recovery or obsessed with cults or trying to get out of a cult or all sorts of different stages. It is nice to take a break and read fiction, but also read fiction that still helps you with your healing process. Can you just give a little summary? How would you describe the book?
So Fierce Little Thing is the story. It's about a group of five friends who are basically raised on a commune that becomes a cult as they are growing up there. And the narrative voice is that of one of those people, Saskia, who we meet when she's first 12 and is recovering from a pretty traumatic event in her family of origin. And is taken in by another family who then in turn bring her to this place called home in rural Maine. It's a very rundown old summer camp, but also kind of magical when you're 12 to get to go run free in a place like that. And there she meets these four other people who are about her age. And in the course of the time that they're living at that place under this charismatic leader, who is a white man named Abraham, they end up making a series of choices that lead them to do something really horrific in a last-ditch attempt to save home from the outside forces that are kind of conspiring against it, or so Abraham would have them believe. And then the book goes back and forth between that past time, where the question kind of is, what did they do? And the present, when Saskia, we meet Saskia again, she's a woman in her middle age. She's in her mid-40s, and she's been basically locked inside her grandmother's house where she now lives for 16 years with very little contact with the outside world. And her friends show up from this other time of life. She hasn't seen them. She's barely talked to them. They show up and they basically say, we're all being blackmailed. We've all been getting these letters about what we did, and we have to go back to Maine. We have to go back to home, and we have to confront whoever is back blackmailing us and basically figure out what to do. The story goes back and forth in time between those two questions. The past question is, what did they do? And the present question is, what will they do as they have to come back from different walks of life, from various estrangements and resentments and a broken love affair, and figure out how to be, you know, how to know each other again.
So good.
So Sarah and I were talking last night about one of the things that inspired you to reach out to us was watching The Vow.
Yes, definitely.
And I thought it was interesting because what were the parallels like with your book and what you saw in The Vow, and what was the inspiration?
Well, so I had a connection to The Vow because my brother-in-law grew up with Bonnie, right? And actually his experience is that she maybe tried to get him to come to a NXIVM event.
Probably, yeah.
That's we all did that.
When he was first.
Part of our job.
He was first in New York.
You know, we all, you know. guilty.
When he was like young in New York and she was like, hey, you should come upstate. We have this
fun
thing.
We all have
thing.
To take that one on the chin. Yeah.
And so, of course, he was like, oh my God, this documentary came out and Bonnie's like all over it. It's Bonnie. It's crazy. This happened to me. So I watched that and I was in the process of, I had written Fierce Little Thing. I knew that this wanted to be set in a commune turned cult. And I can talk a little bit about why that was important to me, given the people in my life who had been involved in places like that. But I also am really careful about research because I feel like you can go down these rabbit holes and then you start to get obsessed with what actually happened. And it's always more interesting and fucked up than what you could imagine. And then you think like, well, that's better. Why would I write a novel? This what happened is better, right? Or crazier or more demented than anything my mind could come up with. And so I had basically kind of walled myself off as I was writing the book from very much research about what was going on. Of course, I couldn't help, because I lived in New York, I couldn't help reading about all the NXIVM stuff as it was coming out, mm-hmm. right? I was aware of that happening and about Keith and about what was going on, but I wasn't actively kind of like saturated in it. So it was such a gift. I don't know if that's a messed up thing to say, but to be able to have access to that story, the way that story is told, obviously the storytelling, as you know, and that is so extraordinary. And I think there's something that one of you say, I think it might be you, Nippy, which is like, you never join a cult. You just wake up one day and you're like, wait, are we in one?
That was Mark, actually.
Yeah, Mark said that.
That's what Mark says. That's right. Mark says that. And I think that is very much the experience of the characters in Fierce Little Thing, especially because they're children, right? They come to home and it is a home for them. And in all cases, really in this book, what I wanted to show was how Abraham plays on everyone's insecurities in the same way that Keith did, right? That this, the trick to being that kind of charismatic leader is that you figure out what everybody's Achilles heel is, right? And then you hold them by it. So in the case of Abraham, in this story, you know, in the story I wrote, he understands that every single one of these people feels like they don't belong. They don't have a place that they belong, right? And so he calls this place home. He says, come, you're at home. This is my home. I will give it to you. And in that way, he also has a power over them because he can always tell them, you don't belong out there. You belong with me here at home, mm-hmm. right? And for the children, especially, that works because they're just kids. They don't know any better. It was really important to me that there be no weird, horrible sex stuff in this book. So I want everyone mm-hmm. to know that there's no sexual abuse in this story.
Thank God.
That was very important to me because I wanted to show that, you know, that is often so often what happens in these kinds of stories, but that it doesn't have to be, mm-hmm. right? Just someone telling you they have power over you is messing you up enough, mm-hmm. right? So when I got into that part in The Vow and was really looking at the way in which Keith had such power over the collective mind, that to me was so fascinating. I'm so interested in the research that Amanda Montell has done in Cultish. You know?
Just to talk really quickly about communes as the backdrop, all of our episodes and all our interviews and all our research always help Nippy and I as well in terms of our own healing. And I had to really think about, like, I love the idea of communal living. You know,
me too. Yeah, I know.
It's amazing. I know that you found yourself there sort of after COVID, sort of by accident.
Yeah, it saved me. Right. I'm living communally now. Basically.
Right. And sharing responsibilities of the home and taking care of the kids. Like, I love that. And I had to think back to my life. Like, I love summer camp. I spent 6 months living on a kibbutz when I was 18. When I first saw Wild Wild Country as part of my cult recovery, I thought, you know, if I was 18 in the 80s, I would have been there in a heartbeat with my red dress.
I know.
That's I'm all over it. We're going to do an episode on Osho.
Sidebar, I grew up in Oregon in the 80s.
Oh, really?
And I remember the adults talking. I remember so clearly all the stuff when the salad bar was poisoned.
No way.
And in fact, we had my mom's college roommate's sister was the head of transportation at Rajneeshpuram.
No way.
We had this kind of like, I remember being like under the table and like hearing adults fretting about it.
Wait, how old are you? Do you mind me asking? Is that too personal?
Yeah. So I was born in 1976. So I would have been like 8, 9, 10.
I'm 77. So we're only a year apart.
Right. So I just like, it was like this childhood backdrop.
Yes.
But I feel like it was so regionalized that like then I came east and had my adult life and no one had heard about that. Hmm. And then Wild Wild Country came out. And I was like, yes, this was like obsessed to my mind for years.
So, if you'd been a little bit older, just like if I'd been a little bit older, that would have been my jam. And I remember that my only connection with it is around grade two. So I guess around the same time, somebody from Oregon moved to Vancouver. Her name was Tui. And she was my really good friend. And she got to dress only in red and pink. And I just thought that was the coolest because, you know, when you're a 7 or 8 year old girl, red and pink, you know, that was it. So I was like, whatever this thing is, I'm in. And her family also introduced me to Michael Jackson, sidebar, because my parents were hippies and not listening to Michael Jackson. So if Tui's listening, whose family was part of Rajneesh, I want to reconnect with you. Anyway, total tangent. My point being, I love the idea of communal living, but like so many times it goes culty. It becomes problematic because, and I think this is what, to circle back to what you were just saying about Amanda Montal and cultish, the language that Abraham used in your book was so accurate. It was like the way that he spoke about, for the audience who doesn't know, he talks about unthinging yourself, separating yourself from basically your attachments to the material world, which, by the way, Heath talked about all the time.
All the gurus talk about that in some capacity, though.
That's true.
Well, because that's how you can get people to go out on a limb with you.
Yeah.
Right? Because you're basically saying, oh, well, none of that matters. But here, over here with me, just keep coming this direction.
Which is actually my chaps my ass, if I may throw it in real quick. Mm-hmm. And you're welcome to one too. Even though you weren't in a cult, if you have a chaps my ass anytime, you can throw it out. But mine was about Keith because, you know, he was, like we just said, always talking about unattaching yourself. But it's really for his own benefit, just like for Abraham's benefit. Like,
yeah,
you know, how he got Saskia's father figure to bring her and like relinquish all his money because he felt guilty being this like New York wealthy artist. Oh, well, just unthing yourself from your money and you can give it to us.
And you can be free. You can be
yourself from your dreams.
Yeah, unthink yourself from your dreams. And it chaps my ass, particularly with Keith, is that he was saying, like, when you're attached, you can't have joy. And yet he was, like, clearly a sex addict.
Right.
You know, and taking everyone else's money and grifting off of them. So that's my chaps my ass. But anyway.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, we talked a little bit about this when we emailed, but, like, you know, I grew up in proximity to communal living. My parents are anthropologists and ethnographers and hippies, as we talked about, like your parents, Sarah. So we lived in rural Senegal for 3 years of my life, which was the most positive communal experience I think I've ever had and that I know of, because we were living in a very ancient way that had its own ways of being that were well established. So my happiest memories of my whole life are living in this tiny village in rural Senegal where my parents were conducting field work and my mom was doing birth work. She's a midwife, so she was catching babies and helping doing, you know, a lot of really important health work there. And then we came back to the States. We came to Vermont, where I live actually, when I was 6, and we were suddenly just the four of us alone in a house. My parents had a baby and I was like, what? This is it? We're just going to be cold in a house now together, just the four of us? That seems like an extreme choice. Because when you're growing up like that, you know, and you're sleeping in your grandmother's bed and there are endless children all around you and there's always a mother to scold you, you know, that life is so full of just so much. And I definitely grew up with the sense of that being so important. And so I was drawn in as I got older to people who had lived in that way. So I have a foster sister who isn't by my biological sister, but I considered to be a sister. And she had grown up on communes on the West Coast. She grew up on a number of communes in Oregon and then up in on an island in Canada, you know, but there were wild horses there and she would ride them and, you know, they lived in a lean-to. It was really, really hard. Mm-hmm. You know, I was younger than her, so I would hear the stories about that time and it was very captivating to me and also obviously really damaging things happened. Her life was not a life in which children were well protected, which does not probably come as a surprise to you. So that was really interesting to me. And then my husband and I have been together since we were 18. So we're now in our mid-40s. So we've grown up together and we met in college. But he was raised for part of his childhood on a political, radical, lesbian commune on the Upper West Side who did a lot of really important political work. And the idea was that they were going to basically liberate the southern part of the United States and turn it into this place called New Africa that would basically be given open to anyone who was Black who wanted to live there. And all white people would have to move out of that space. And it would basically be the idea of repatriation. It was a very extreme concept, mm-hmm. but it was this really important political idea around Black liberation. And the intricacies of what happened within that space almost all boil down to really difficult interpersonal relationships between women who were really hard on each other, right?
Wow.
So like they go from this kind of grand concept, mm-hmm. right, of like what you're going to do to save the world. And then the ways in which that played out were really about kind of like, you know, every night they would have this meeting in which basically they would talk about all the flaws, all the
say,
things that everybody
feedback.
Had done wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds give right. feedback.
All these political groups do that.
You know, and it would always turn into like, oh, we think you're slutty, right? Or you think you don't do enough dishes, right? It would always turn into like, actually, the difficulties of what these women were kind of feeling right. about each other that were not necessarily helpful towards the cause. And for my husband, he was the only male growing up in this space. So there were other girls and women, but he was the only boy. And so that was really challenging and damaging mm-hmm. messaging to mm-hmm. him in a lot of ways about the ways in which his own body was like a source of violence.
Wow.
That required a lot of kind of help for him as right. he got older, but also has had wonderful ways in which it has affected our marriage, because I am essentially married to someone who does much more of the housework than I do, mm-hmm. does a significant amount of child care. You know, I think we have probably the most split marriage in terms of like domestic chores than anyone I know.
He's probably sensitive to things that most men aren't.
Yeah, he's very aware. And that doesn't mean that there aren't these. And in some ways, it's kind of those moments when he's clueless. I'm like, are you kidding me? Yeah. Because I think I'm dealing with someone who is completely evolved out of that. And then I had a friend in high school who was very close to, who was from a big family, and I really loved their family. And she kind of disappeared halfway through high school. And it turned out that she had gone to join the ashram that her parents had been on, which is called Adida. And they follow this guru, Adida Samraj, down in Humboldt County and also in Hawaii. He has now been dead for many years, but they still maintain it as though he is there. And she's still part of that.
Wow.
So I remember the kind of when she disappeared and she came back. She came back for like a week and we saw each other. And of course, I was like 16. So I was like, I still have a crush on that boy. And, you know, I got the lead in the school play. And she was like talking about metaphysics and about the fact that she was like, had entered this, you know, love triangle that was going to change her life, entered this marriage with these two other people. And she was so happy. And then I didn't see her for many years, but I was living in New York. It was like in the early days of Facebook, she emailed me on Facebook and was like, I'm here. I'm getting my degree at Columbia. I'd love to see you. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. She's left. She left that program. And so she was like, you know, my partner and I would love to see you. And so we went. They invited us over to their apartment and I walked in. I realized it was in this big house in Ditmas Park, which is like where there are these huge Victorian houses. It doesn't look like New York, what you think of as New York City. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's these giant Victorians. And it was, I guess, when those were still kind of affordable. Now you would never be able to do this. But I walked in and I was like, oh my God, everyone here is in the cult. And it was actually their house. They're kind of like outposts.
Wow.
And it was all people who had moved to New York for various reasons who were doing the work of that ashram.
And did she try to recruit you?
Yeah, then they tried to recruit me.
What was that like?
Well, it was interesting because I was with a friend who's a novelist, Emily Rabiteau, who one of the things I love about Emily is that she's always like, take notes, everything is material. Right. So I'd invited her with me to come to this house, and Emily, like, we went into the bathroom one point. She was like, they're recruiting us. They're recruiting us. And I was like, do you think so? It's just so weird. And she was like, stay in it, because I want to know everything they're going to try to put us. And of course, like, my friend's partner had gotten out there, like, the book about their leader and was showing her pictures and was like, take this. And, you know, was talking about how he wanted us to experience love and how beautiful it would be to be part of this community. And it was really fascinating.
Wow.
So I saw them a few more times, and she and I are kind of in touch on Facebook, and she's actually been instrumental in kind of like a counter argument online about how they are not a cult in answer to this podcast that came out.
So she's still in it.
She's still in it.
Wow. tell our stories, we change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org. Did anyone learn a language in high school and then let it go and then have regrets about that later? If you're anything like me, then maybe you'll relate. I did French all the way up into 12th grade, and then I let it go. I mean, I lived in Montreal for a few years and, you know, practiced a bit, but it just slipped away. And then I found Babbel. Babbel is the language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions. And thanks to Babbel's addictively fun and easy little bite-sized language lessons, I've been able to get back my French. I've actually found learning French to be fun again. And c'est vrai, je parle français. With Babbel, you only need 10 minutes to complete a lesson, so you can start having real-life conversations in a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 150 language experts and voiced by real native speakers, not computers. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. And with Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Formidable. That means wonderful in French. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. Clearly still working on that. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of 3. Just go to babbel.com and use promo code CULTY. That's BABBEL.com, code CULTY. Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
We've joked about in this pod and heard elsewhere, like, as soon as you start defending how your group is not a cult, it's probably a cult.
I really work hard to believe on people when they say something has abused them. Mm-hmm. So the testimony of this young man talking about the way in which his life there has abused him has made me think, like, I don't think it's a great place.
No. Yeah. Well, that's actually a good point. You know, we try to give like nuggets to our listeners for analyzing this stuff. And that's one of the things that's come up a lot where we've talked about something, a different group or whatever. And other people wrote us being like, oh man, like I wish you hadn't said it was a cult or culty because like I had a really good experience. And then we keep having to say over and over again, it's very possible for someone to have a good or a great or a fantastic or life-changing experience. It doesn't mean that somebody else wasn't abused or hurt or that it,
right,
you know, that behind closed doors, worse things are happening that you don't know about. And that's sort of like what one of the big takeaways we've had from this research. Wouldn't you say, Nippy? Like many people that went to NXIVM had great experiences.
Sure. Some of the arguments when we were leaving was that that's not my experience. It's going to be. It's kind of my response, you know,
at some point.
Yeah.
Not yet. Yeah. It's not.
We had an experience after we did a episode with a guy named Douglas Brooks, who's kind of the lawyer MLM guy who went through all of the MLMs, uh-huh, all the tactics and how they have culty aspects. Like the reason our podcast is just stretching your thinking on things that could be a little bit culty and the precursors to abuse. Right. And MLMs are, you know, most people just, they'll hear it and they'll just roll their eyes and leave. And some people get drawn into however schemes they do. And we had run into someone who was a supporter of our show, and we run into them and they go something to the effect of, yeah, I heard the episode. I beg to differ. I have a different perspective on that. Well, that was this person's life.
He's in an MLM. Like, he loves our podcast.
Here's what he's saying and just denies it. And I understood it. His livelihood is rooted in it.
It's so inconvenient and heartbreaking because you think like, this did good things for me. And I think especially MLMs, the thing that's so fascinating to me about them is the amount of work. I know you went through this experience with Nexium, but the amount of work to rope other people in, people you care about, thinking you're doing something good for them. Mm-hmm. And then part of the destruction of the self is to have to realize, if I'm finally admitting that it's not good, I'm having to admit that I did damage to other people.
Oh, yeah. That's a huge part of our recovery.
Even if you didn't do damage to other people, you were rubbing elbows with people who were. And you were working with it. I still struggle with that a little bit. I read something recently about one of the people that Nexium went after. My big question after we left was, you know, how was this ecosystem in upstate New York allowed to thrive with government officials, and people were blowing the whistle and had been for quite some time. And we're finding that out a little bit right now. And one of the people that was persecuted pretty heavily was a guy named John Teague. And I'm reading his story now. It's coming out. And to find out that certain people that I went to work with every day were participating in that. It's just a hard thing to kind of go, really? It's still hard to reconcile.
It's so hard. I had an interesting kind of a little bit culty experience era of my life. The person who I went to high school with, the high school he went to, is this very progressive, very loved, still quite wonderful school in Oregon. And I was a scholarship kid. You know, my parents were hippies. Like, we didn't have any money. And I got this amazing scholarship starting in eighth grade to go to the school. And it was on a campus. And, you know, it was like open campus. And there was like all of these incredible progressive classes. It just blew my mind. It was like college, right? And I was like this super brainy kid. And that school changed my life. You know, I wouldn't be who I am if I hadn't gotten to go to that school. And a couple years ago, there's this huge sexual abuse scandal that broke. 40 years, many, many teachers, including my English teacher, the man who drove my carpool every day, wow. You know, people who were really important to me and helped me understand who I am. And to discover that all that time, there was all this stuff going on that I had no idea about and that never touched me. And then to talk to friends who were like, oh yeah, that guy grabbed my breasts on the eighth grade trip. Ugh. And I was like, what? Right? Because there's something so hard about having a place, right, change your life like that. Mm-hmm. And then to have to reconcile, how do I put that with the pain that it has caused the people who I loved, and that all this was happening and I didn't have any idea? You really think you're crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think for many people, it's easier to believe, well, my perception must be the reality.
Yeah.
Right. That everyone else must be wrong because it's so real to me that it was a good place. And I think that's where we have a very difficult time in, I think it is capitalism. There's this idea that it's like yes or no, black or white, good or bad. And nothing's that.
Nothing's binary. Yeah.
Nothing is binary. That's the hook, line, and sinker we buy from the beginning.
Right.
Right. A lot of getting through this kind of stuff is realizing that place did change my life and it also ruined people's lives.
Which I think, just circling back to your book, you really painted that picture so well with home, with the compound. And I'm so curious about your writing process. I saw in the back of the book that you read a bunch of books about living off the land and farming, and particular The Sociopath Next Door, which I've not read yet, but I will.
Oh, you got to read
it. I will definitely. I feel like I know them well now, but could always add to the repertoire. So you have a mixture of your experience, not direct, but proximity experience with culty commune stuff. And then you write this book, you decide to set it in a commune turned cult. How much of your writing of Abraham, which was so bang on, like I was saying, was based on your research? Because like, there's just certain things that he did that I was like, yep, check mark, check mark.
You know, I think one of the things that's so interesting about being a writer is you imagine what you would do if you were that person, which is terrifying.
Right.
Right. Like, I'm a really compassionate person. I don't want to hurt people. But I think the answer, I mean, you know, it's so weird, the job I have, because it's like part of the job I have is a little magic, kind of like acting, right? You're like, I don't know how I do it. I don't know how. I know a lot of it is work and stubbornness, but there's maybe like 8% of it that I don't understand. And that's the part of it, which is like crawling inside the skin of someone else and understanding from a deep level how you would manipulate a group of people to get what you wanted. I just tapped into that, which scares me about myself. I think maybe shows that it is the deep human impulse. Most of us maybe learn how to unlearn. Mm-hmm. I mean, anytime you've spent a time with a toddler, you know that there is an impulse to become a total dictator in all of us.
Absolutely.
Right? And
for sure.
And one of the jobs as a parent is to teach your kid to unlearn that, right? And you talked about mothers before, and I thought so much about mothers in this book. The book is dedicated to the mothers, some mothers, and the people who made me imagine them, because there are so many mothers in this book who are trying to do the best they can in what feel like impossible circumstances, trying to help their children unlearn that in the face of what feels like very, very high stakes circumstances for them. Like, I think Saskia, I don't know that anyone has said her sociopath, but I think she knows from the time she's a little girl that there's something different about her. And I think her journey goes from thinking, oh, I'm like this man, and I can learn how to use my power the same way he uses his power, but I'll use it for good things, coming to a place where she understands I'm not like him because I'm choosing love. Mm-hmm. I'm choosing to care for the people who I put my arms around. And that is love. That is what love is. And he doesn't know what love is. His idea of love is that it's all about what he can trade. You know, mm-hmm. that idea that you're talking about with Keith, which is like how you can get more for yourself. That's all what Abraham's doing.
He's mm-hmm. taking.
Yeah. And she thinks that she's like that. For me, the moment of redemption in the book comes the moment at the very, very, very end of the book, not to give a spoiler because it doesn't really give it away, but the moment when she discovers, oh, I'm choosing to do something loving. And I won't tell you what that is because it's a dark choice. But I think for her, that is an act of love, mm-hmm. which is kind of extraordinary for her because she hasn't been shown much love in her life.
Like, all of those interpersonal dynamics are so consistent with what can happen in these culty environments, I think. And that's something that you really nailed. And also was really interesting, especially when these five characters are teenagers in this context, because mm-hmm. I came in my late 20s, but it sort of helped me reflect on like, how much would I love this commune as a teenager?
Yeah. I love writing about people over the course of their lives. Like, I think there's something so fun about like going to a college reunion mm-hmm. because you see these people who you remember so vividly, even if you don't know mm-hmm. them well. Right? These people stick out in your mind. You're like, that guy, he was always kicking a soccer ball. And then you see him and he's a grown man. And you think like, do you still even play soccer? Right?
Right.
They're all, I mean, that's a tiny little example, but there was something so fun about this book about getting to know these people as children and then having there kind of be this artificial ending to knowing them as children and then suddenly knowing them again as middle-aged people. Right? Because there are ways in which they are precisely who they are. And right. then there are ways in which their trauma and their life has led them to try to be different. You know, and Saskia's relationships with each of them was always so compelling to me. Like, I think Cornelia, who's kind of like the middle-aged mom, soccer mom lady in the
totally
book,
related to her closest, too.
Yeah, she's probably the closest to me as a person in terms of like who she is. And Saskia finds her deeply annoying.
Yeah.
Both in the past and present. Like,
I felt,
you know,
that.
Like Saskia like loathes her because she's just too perfect.
Because she's so gluten-free, right? Like, that's her.
Yeah. She's so gluten-free and she does yoga and everything.
Yeah.
Everything's so great for her. but actually, like, Saskia comes to a place of such love for mm-hmm. her and understanding for her when Cornelia finally says, like, all I have is being a mom.
Yeah.
That is how I get through this horrible thing, is I give something different to my children. This is a weird thing to say when you're writing people, but that was moving to me when I encountered that, because yeah. I was like, oh, that is the truth for this character.
It was also really moving. Like, I cried hard when the book was over, A, because of the decisions and, you know, how things are revealed at the end, which mm-hmm. I won't give away. But also because I was like, I didn't want to let it go. You know, I didn't want to say goodbye to these characters. Like, I really wanted to stay with them and like heal with them, you know? It was so beautiful.
Thank you. And I was really interested when I watched The Vow, watching your relationship and Bonnie and Mark's relationship, like the challenge of being in this place where there is also a love attachment between you and someone else. Like, how does that play out? How are the ways in which it needs to be kind of deprogrammed when you leave that place? And for Saskia and Ben, obviously, they have to kind of reckon with that for other reasons too. But there's the scene towards the end of the book in a canoe, where they go out on a canoe together. That scene, like, as I was writing it, I was just crying because I felt like it was such a beautiful moment between them to get to just love each other in this pure way that would never work. Mm. You know, that the world would never allow that of them, but they get to have it in this moment together in a canoe, not even touching each other, but just being together. And I don't know, it really made me wonder, this whole book is about these group of people and their relationships within this space. And how can you forge those relationships? And then how do you carry them out when you leave that place?
I loved how that was also against, even though it was fiction, it was against the backdrop of the real world, and how you reference things like the siege at Waco and Ruby Ridge with FLDS, things that I'd studied in my cult recovery, things I didn't know about before mm-hmm. I was in NXIVM. But as somebody who's like now fairly well researched, I was like, yes, it's like to perceive those events from the eyes of someone who's still in something and using that as fuel as like, see, this is why we need to get guns, because the FBI are going to get us.
They're out there right now watching us.
Out there. They could be in the woods and also will be, you know, another tool, yet another tool for introspection for people in cult recovery, because seeing that dynamic through the eyes of somebody else is a lot easier, I think, to unravel some of that fanatical thinking that is hard to fathom if you haven't gone through it yourself.
I think it was also really to have it be, you know, it was easy to write because it were teenagers. I live with a teenager right now, and teenagers, like everything's, the dial is turned up, mm-hmm. right? Like teenagers are ready to feel. They're ready to just like have it all come through them like a storm, mm-hmm. right? And it was really kind of wonderful to write not just life on a cult, but also life interpersonally between a group of five teenagers who, of course, all have their different packs and secrets, and the ways in which then that gets amplified if you place it within a space in which there's kind of that power mm-hmm. structure. And also to have the children basically be encouraged to be, by the charismatic leader, to kind of be front and center, right? When he takes them out and he says, like, I realize you are the heart of this place, mm-hmm. right? Are you kidding me? Like when you're 13, that's all you want. Mm-hmm. It's for someone to say like, you're in charge. Yeah. You're right. You're in control. And of course he's doing that because he realizes he can manipulate them much more easily than he can manipulate the adults.
He gives them what they want, also gives them a sense of belonging. All of those things that we've been talking about. Hey there, hope you're enjoying the episode. Quick reminder to follow us on Instagram. You can also share your favorite episodes with friends who may or may not be in a cult, and also reach out to us to let us know who you would love to hear as a guest. And now, a word from our sponsors. Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Latinx podcasters are making an impact. Keep listening to discover our faves, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Welcome to Not Your Average Joe, the podcast that will make anyone a little less average. I'm your host, Joe Franco, and I'm so excited to get into this. I'm a writer, a TV host, a content creator, and a polyglot. And throughout all of these experiences, I've met some of the most fascinating people all around the world that I'd love to introduce you to. We'll have conversations about different topics, ranging from finance to fitness to language learning and wanderlust. With each episode, we'll dissect real-life stories and turn them into tangible takeaways so that we can all be a little less average. I learn, you learn, we all learn. Don't forget to like and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
I feel also that there's like this shift in the zeitgeist, for lack of a better word, where all this culty content is coming out. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's been a shift to where people who are portrayed in these contexts are no longer like whack jobs or like vulnerable, broken people. They're people who are on a journey.
Oh, that was something we talked so much about as a family when we saw The Vow.
Tell me.
Which is just the idea of like that it's so much smarter to manipulate a group of people who have capacity and ambition, right? Than it is to try to do that with a bunch of losers. Like we have this idea that you'd only like put a cult together from people who are like, you know, kind of crazy and out there and can't wipe themselves, right? And instead it's like, no, you find a group of people. And I thought like, wow, I mean, as a working artist myself, I was like, to particularly captivate people who are in Hollywood, who have made it just enough to have a whetted appetite where what they want is to be climbing, right? That's what Hollywood is all about. It's like, how do you get the next audition? How do you get the better part? But then to basically be able to say, well, I can help you master that, right? Because what is happening there is it's harnessing a certain kind of ambition that already exists within the person, right? So it fuels itself.
Yes.
There's a couple other aspects to it. There's a structure to NXIVM that Hollywood doesn't have. Right?
The necessarily.
Also, Hollywood, and this is what I noticed particularly with a lot of people that were at the point that you were talking about, Hollywood's notorious for not really having a morality. And this pretended to offer a morality in how you chose roles and what you wanted to stand for. And
ethics.
You were grabbing, you were grabbing the kind of rudder to your own ship and standing for what you wanted to against maybe Hollywood norms, which is, you know, can feel empowering intellectually and theoretically.
In the face of if you're walking into auditions and someone's like, I hate your nose, right? Which is like, what can you do with that, you know?
Because it wasn't just about success or ambition, because a lot of people that came were already very successful. It was also about meaning and having, like, you can be successful and have a meaningful existence, you know?
Yeah. I had ideas about that, but I hadn't thought about them in kind of that high a level yet. Mm-hmm. But I love that moment when that gets pointed out in the series, because you realize, oh, right. Like this can only work when you are building it on a stable enough foundation, on the backs of people who are going to do some of that work for you because they have the capacity to do it.
Also, they have the credibility with their friends. Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, well, you need hard workers. You know. You need worker bees. You need people who are just going to hunker down and get it done and like make the Excel spreadsheets and, you know, put out the tortillas for lunch, you know, with tenacity.
And that's something I really thought a lot about with the women in Fierce Little Thing, and with Sarah, who is the cook and like feeds everybody and has an understanding. She has this kind of like superpower to be able to like stretch any meal, right? And Gabby, who is like doing all of the work in terms of like building things and figuring out how to run a, you know, a sewer line and putting in a wood stove that isn't there. Know that those people, that Abraham is just essentially sitting in his cabin, like writing a treatise or whatever, you know, just like Keith. It's like you can sit around and be a blowhard if you have the people who are going to actually make sure that you get fed and you're warm and that you get all the basic needs you have.
Yeah, you nailed that aspect. Also, the surrounding women to make it possible to be a charismatic, espousing how to live your life doctrine vibe.
Yeah, this is something else I thought a lot about in terms of Saskia, is like her kind of idea, both this kind of split idea of being both this like special girl, which I think is a very particular, I felt like as a child, I was like a special girl, which was like, I was really smart. I was pretty enough, but not too pretty. I could like please adults because I fit all of these kind of like boxes. And if someone like Abraham had found me at the same age as Saskia, I would have been in like that. All I wanted was someone to say you're special. But then also she has such shame about these kind of secret parts of herself that she keeps hidden. And shame is, I think, for many women, like the primary force of how you encounter the world. You know, how the world has power over you.
Religion.
Yeah.
It's a really good thing I didn't meet you in 2008. I would have tried to recruit you into Jeunesse for sure. We could talk about these things.
But I mean, you know, but that was something I saw in the Vow constantly, which was just this idea of like all these women, you included, who were like being motivated by kind of like this sense of am I good enough? Mm-hmm. If you ask a woman, are you good enough? Right? If you were to walk up to any woman and say, are you good enough? It's so interesting because I think most women would be like, I'm sure I am. Right? That is something fundamentally we carry inside of ourselves.
Well, a guy would say yes, even if he knew he wasn't, probably.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's the difference.
That's actually the ending of my book, Miranda, is I realized like this whole thing, the way he was able to extract so much from us is because it was based on the assumption that I'm not good enough and I'm broken and I need to be fixed. And I'm going to pay you millions of dollars. And that's like what I try to translate to people. Like, yeah, you can do self-improvement if you want, but like you can do it on the premise that you're okay already. You're fine. Actually, you're whole and complete.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say as a mother of a daughter, like every night when I put her to bed, I say, you're so smart. You're so strong. You're so capable and you're so kind.
Yeah.
And I say that to her every night because I know that the world is going to do its damnedest to take that out of her.
Totally.
And then I often say to her, what's something smart you did today? What's something kind you did today? What's something capable you did today?
Wow.
You know,
that's awesome.
Because I really think it's important for her to know I have that in me. I am those things. Because, you know, Saskia, that is what Saskia, that's her burden.
Yeah.
Right? Is that she doesn't think she's any of those things until she finally, as an adult woman, kind of chooses to know that about herself.
Yeah. Which ironically is the empowerment that she was sold in the beginning. And that's what we see in all the cults is there's always that bait and switch. It's like, we're going to give you this, but it's actually this. You think it's empowerment, right, but it's disenfranchisement, but it's her making her choice at the end to actually be empowered.
Yeah, that's her journey. Mm-hmm.
Not to give too much away.
No, but I mean, I think we've done a good job of hiding. There's a lot of big things that happen in the plot.
And it's really
right. There's a lot of big plot in this book.
It's going to be made into a movie, right? I think we've discussed.
I hope so.
We've discussed, and I've already put my ask in to audition for one of the many women around Abraham. I'm not asking for a handout. I just want to audition for it. Okay.
Definitely. Yes. Definitely.
So fingers crossed for you on that.
Fingers crossed.
Did you have any chaps your asses about your experience?
Plural. Wait, to me, plurals there.
plural ass chapping about, I'll give you a couple contexts. I guess either about like culty shit that you see right now in the world or in the people that because I know you have close people around you that went through similar experiences, one or the other or both. What's the thing that's like really chaps your ass?
I feel like one thing that chaps my ass, I'll say about the literary world, which is a little culty sometimes, there's this illusion that if you work hard enough, you will rise like cream to the top. In fact, the literary world is filled with the question of who you know and who you like and who likes you, whose butt you've kissed. And this plays out in every aspect of the literary world. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't have great success if you don't do those things, but it is consistently amazing to me how often people get accolades, prizes, grants. And if you know them, you're like, I know who was on that committee and I know why that lady got that. And it's amazing. It is the cult of publishing and the cult of the literary world. This idea that like hard work and talent is what gets you on top. It is definitely not that.
I bet.
You touch on, another box that could be added to a little bit culty is when they pretend to be meritocracies but aren't.
Exactly. And there are plenty of people, I will say, there are plenty of people who get there on their own, and that's wonderful, but it is a lot harder. Yeah.
So is what you're saying, my book is not a bestseller because I didn't know the right person.
Sarah.
I mean, honestly, I've had one New York Times bestseller, and it was amazing to watch how that happened because it has to do with so many different elements, one of them being luck, but a lot of it having to be like that it is mutually agreed upon by people in power that it is going to do a good job. You can hustle as much as you want. I think it's important to hustle. I hustle. Mm-hmm. But, you know, ultimately, there is no way that hustling could ever get you what the people in charge deciding that this book is going to do it.
So they create the market for it then in a lot of ways.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Which stifles creativity because you could have a totally original idea. And if the powers that be decide it's not an original idea, it's not going to get endorsed.
And that's only, I mean, and there's less and less coverage for books now.
Yeah.
You choose the safe bet. I mean, and it's a business, right? It's capitalism. Yep. So like, I decided long ago that like, I could not get wrapped up in feeling badly for not playing all the game all the way.
Yeah.
But it is definitely, there are moments when you're like, wow, okay, Sure.
When I wrote my memoir, I didn't even have that like ambition because that's not why I wrote it. But then when I did, I was like seeing how other people got there. I remember asking and every single person told me a different reason as to how one becomes a bestseller. I still don't really understand it. That makes a bit more sense. So maybe we'll do a whole other episode on that, Nip, or maybe this is it. Maybe this is the episode of the cultiness of the literary world.
I think that's the extent of it right there. We
stuck it in. And the other thing I was going to say to end, again, without giving anything away, that I loved how that there were two remaining members after everything fell apart at home, but those two remaining members joined another commune in upstate New York. And I'm just wondering, was that Nexium?
Oh, no, it was in Iowa.
Oh, shoot.
No, but then they go to upstate New York. Yes, it wasn't Nexium. It wasn't. But I probably like absorbed that. And maybe I thought it was Nexium without saying what it was to myself.
There's a lot up there. Nexium had competition.
They're super into agriculture. So I don't know if they would like they're really in, I don't know, was Nexium, were there any cows?
Here's what would have happened. Keith would have been like, oh, you're into agriculture? And he would have done some word salad about how important agriculture is and how he's been looking for someone in agriculture. And why don't you come sit on my lap? We'll talk about agriculture.
Or he would come up with a business idea that was doomed to fail and have the person on a hamster wheel trying to make it
be in charge of that work.
And then said, you're the cause of global warming. Why don't you solve that?
Yeah.
Some shit like that.
Oh, so great. We covered the gamut today. Mm-hmm. Motherhood, cults.
Yep.
Everything.
All of it.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you reaching out.
Oh, thank you.
And writing such a beautiful, emotional, raw, gritty, interesting, challenging, wonderful book. So thank you.
That means the world to me. Thank you both for having me.
Imagine yourself walking into a forest. You can see the path and the trees. High above you, the air is crisp. You are walking towards your happy place. Allegedly, say it with me. Anything said here on this podcast about alleged cults, alleged MLM schemes, alleged douchebaggery, mindfuckery, criminality, spiritual fraud, or the like, is offered purely as commentary. Because the views and opinions expressed on A Little Bit Culty do not necessarily reflect on official policy or position of the podcast. And any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. So just let these words drift into your mind without needing to focus on any of them. You are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. Nobody's mad at you, unless you're actually a narcissistic, culty criminal. If that's you, cut that shit out. Don't be a fuckwad. But if that's not you, again, you are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. A Little Bit Culty loves you.
Well, that was fun.
That was fun.
And one of the things that I think was kind of fun about her book is that the leader, Abraham, the charismatic leader we talked about, did have some word salad-y nuggets, but I thought you might have one.
It's funny. I do. It's interesting. To the mind of someone who is, in essence, pursuing truth, if you will, who is immersed in the quest to understand life, as it were, who sees the false as false and the truth in the false. Occultish, cultist things are fairly obvious. And such a mind won't touch them. It is totally unimportant whether one can read your thoughts or you can read my thoughts, whether I can see angels, fairies, or have visions. We want something mysterious, in essence. But we don't see the immense mystery in living, in the love of living. We don't see that, so we spend ourselves in things that don't matter. As it were.
What was that from?
Dude, I follow this thing, Krishna Mert Foundation or whatever. He's like this guru, and some of the stuff he says like kind of works. That one was just verbal diarrhea.
I did not understand it.
No.
But I smiled along, smiled and nodded.
Right, exactly. Exactly. That's how it works. Case in point.
You're really good at this.
I don't know if that's a good thing. I've had practice.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.
sinking down to the depths of the ocean. I'm hanging on to the wind of my love. If I let go of it all, I could leave, but I know.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. Takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.